From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. After being named artistic director of the Atlanta Repertory Theater, Michael Howard told a group of local businessmen, "My theater is going to be the best in the country." The ensemble launched its first production at the Alliance Theater 50 years ago, Henry Purcell's King Arthur. Now the largest regional theater in the Southeast, the Alliance has premiered Tony-winning plays, attracted A-list actors, nurtured the dramatic passions of children and young playwrights, and committed to representing the diversity of its community. We are talking about how the Alliance Theater has evolved as it kicks off its 50th season with a new renovation. Michael Parver is here, and he was there at the beginning. He is now on Alliance Theater's advisory board. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Jamie Clements is also with us. He's director of development at Alliance Theater. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, good morning and thank you for being here. Now, Michael, you were the PR guy 50 years ago when the theater first opened in Atlanta. Was Atlanta known as a theater town?
Actually, no. And let me just correct something. I was vice president of production.
Well, excuse me for the demotion, sir.
You're more than welcome.
So it wasn't really a theater town. This was part of a multi-million dollar venue, Memorial Arts Center, now Woodruff Arts Center, with an orchestra, a theater, an opera, ballet. Can you give us a little history on how this got going? One of the largest artistic centers in the country still.
Well, actually, what happened was the whole Memorial Arts Center was really built for the Atlanta Symphony. That was the big draw. Robert Shaw was the conductor. About 3 years before it opened, Mr. Woodruff met with Chris Manis, the man who had been producing theater under the stars at Chastain, a six-week season of musical theater, and something called the winter play season, which were stars at a 700-seat theater, the Woman's Club Theater here on Peachtree Street. He said, "I've got a problem. We've built this wonderful, or are building this wonderful structure for the symphony. They're only going to be performing like two, three nights a week. It's going to sit empty. We've got this 700-plus theater that's supposed to be rented out for special events. Is there any way we can fill that theater?" And Chris said, "Yes." And with the blessings and I think the financial help of Mr. Woodruff, he put together an opera company, a theater company, a children's theater company, and took the Atlanta Ballet and made them professional. And we had to figure out what the first production was going to be. And Chris decided, let's do something that has never been seen in America, King Arthur. The reason it hasn't been seen is it needed a theater company, opera company, and ballet company.
Well, that's something. I was reading the review from the New York Times. They have it in their time capsule. Harold Schoenberg wrote, "There has been no stinting in production. This is a lavish effort." So had there been a precedent before for this kind of cooperative production, ballet, opera, symphony in a 20th century theater?
Actually, not in America, no. This was a 17th century production originally.
So there's a revival for you.
Which is kind of similar because right now our opening show in the new theater is a musical that had been done 4 years ago, but is now being redone, and from everything I hear, fabulously.
This is Ever After. Jamie, give us a little perspective on that. This was a super ambitious production of this play right out of the gate. Was it a success?
Ever After? Well, we haven't started
it
yet.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. First I meant King Arthur.
Well, you know, King Arthur, I think in discussing with Michael, there's a really interesting thing that our artistic director, Susan Booth, says quite often, actually, that with all great art, there's inherent risk and quite a bit of it. And I think a lot of times the more risk, the better the art. And so King Arthur was filled with tremendous amounts of risk. And so from that standpoint, it was great art. And it was, you know, unfortunately, I wasn't around back then. But for a whole lot of reasons, it was the right show to open with. for what was then one of the most ambitious artistic products projects that the South had ever seen. And so I think, you know, whether a monetary success or not, luckily art is not judged on monetary success.
Well, basically, we got so much attention, over 40 national critics came down here. And the Today Show came and filmed an entire hour and a half before we opened, which drew the attention of these critics to come. King Arthur, the opening show, was a tremendous success. It ran for originally 5 weeks, sold out every performance, added another week before it closed. Then our shows ran into trouble for two reasons. Primarily, there was something called the Hong Kong flu that hit America in that time frame.
Wow.
And that kept people from going out. Over 1 million people died from the Hong Kong flu that year. At the same time, no nonprofit theater can ever sustain itself with ticket sales. Mm-hmm. You have to have fundraisers. You have to have people like Riches and Scripto giving you additional money, plus the public. We were set to do a fundraiser immediately after we opened King Arthur, mm-hmm. going on all the publicity. The Alliance at that time, we were not a member of the Alliance. The theater, we were a tenant. We're supposed to be a tenant for 2 years, and if everything was successful, then become a member of the Alliance. The Alliance came to Chris and said, we've got to do our fundraiser in October. You're going to have to wait till April. Unfortunately, we were not able to wait till April. So after doing another three or four shows and very diverse productions, we ended up closing the theater in January.
Mm. So obviously things got righted. 2 years later, you became a part of Alliance Theater.
No, the Alliance took over what we had created, kept the children's theater, kept the repertory theater, changed its name to the Alliance Theater, and kept it going.
Well, obviously, things did keep going. 50 years later, the Alliance Theater is kicking off its 50th season with a production of Ever After in a newly renovated theater. That's Michael Parver. He was there at the beginning. He's now a member of the advisory board, and Jamie Clements, director of development at Alliance Theater, is also with us. Through the years, Jamie, big stars came to town. Like, who was attracted to the Alliance Theater?
You know, I think that, again, going back to what our artistic director says all the time, is not only are patrons attracted to great art and sometimes risky theater, but most importantly, great storytelling. And I think that we've seen, you know, over Susan's 17-year tenure now, some really remarkable folks. You know, we've had Stephen King who premiered one of his musicals here. Elton John was involved. Oprah Winfrey was involved with the opening of The Color Purple, which started at the Alliance Theater. Lin-Manuel Miranda was involved with one of his early productions here at the Alliance Theater, actually. We have Terrell Alvin McCraney, who, you know, won for Moonlight. He had a very early one of his plays as part of our National Graduate Playwriting Competition that the Candida Fund has so graciously supported. And so we not only help start wonderful careers here for actors and playwrights and directors and lighting designers and costumers and drapers and so on and so on and so on, but also we attract people who are in the prime of their careers because they see great art happening here at the Woodruff Art Center, at the Alliance Theater, in this little sleepy town of Atlanta, which is hosting a pretty big football game in a few weeks. But it's after we open our brand new stage, Coca-Cola Stage.
Right. The second big thing happening in January. Kenny Leon was the first associate artistic director of color, and then he became artistic director in 1988. I spoke with him last summer about mm-hmm. that time. Let's just hear a little clip of that.
So when I went to the Alliance Theater, I couldn't pretend I was someone else. When I went stepped through those doors, I was a black kid who grew up poor in Tallahassee, Florida, who was now trying to introduce the theater to new writers and introduce new audiences to that theater.
Jamie, at the time he joined, the audience was 90% white, and a slice of Atlanta who could afford to subscribe. How did his mission to produce work from diverse playwrights and actors go over?
You know, it was a really interesting time for the Alliance Theater, but I think that much like King Arthur, kind of great risk comes great reward. And we're so grateful to Kenny for helping to open the eyes of our patron base, but also expand our patron base and also attract other great artists to come on the staff of the Alliance Theater. And, you know, Kenny has continued to help diversify the field. And I think that's something that's so important. You know, his successor that he just named at True Colors Theater, he's giving another opportunity for a great person of color to come on to the scene in the theatrical world. And, you know, Susan has continued that through her partnership with Dr. Mary Schmidt-Campbell at Spelman with our Spelman Leadership Fellows program. There's an important tenet of the theater that is finally growing its legs and being able to come to the surface, and that is that there are great stories in every person who walks on this on the face of this earth. And until we have people who look quite different from one another, all around the same tables, all around all the tables, not only at theater, but in television and radio and other things, we're not going to hear all the great stories that are out there. And I think both Kenny and Susan have continued to make sure that we're hearing great stories all the time.
So many things have happened at the theater. Under his tenure and Susan Booth's, we want to hear just a little clip from Elton John and Tim Rice's musical Aida, which did go on to Broadway and won the Tony Award for Best Original Musical Score. Here's just a clip from that. A little bit there from Aida, one of those plays that made its premiere at the Alliance Theater here in Atlanta. And of course, Alliance has had its share of crowd pleasers, certainly, but also deeply experimental plays. How does a theater walk that line between, you know, those that are going to pull people in because they've got big names and those that are going to take a little time to build?
It's a crapshoot, quite frankly. And you've got to have guts. And what the current Alliance Theater is doing is fabulous. But it also happens that when we first opened 50 years ago, in one of our first two productions in the Little Theater that's now the Hertz, one was called The Wedding Band, which was a black and white couple that got married in the early 1900s. The second production was called In White America, which dealt with the whole history of the black man and woman here in America. And we had integrated casts from the beginning. King Arthur was integrated. In fact, one of the kings.
Mm-hmm, one of the leads. I saw right. The photos from that. I was a little stunned, actually. This is 1968.
Chris worked very, very closely with the black community. I happen to have been involved with Dr. Martin Luther King back in Tulane when I went to college and continued that relationship. We actually were the company that opened up the Just Us Theater, the first complete black theater here in America.
Well, we're learning a little bit about the legacy of Alliance Theater, an anchor and seedbed for Atlanta arts for half a century. Let's go out with just a little bit from The Color Purple, Alice Walker's play, or a play based on her book that made its premiere at Alliance Theater. Michael Parver is with us and Jamie Clements. We're going to be back in just a few moments after a quick break and learn a little bit about where it's going in the future. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Alliance Theater is celebrating its 50th anniversary with Ever After. Previews begin tomorrow. It is a regional theater, Tony winner. It's premiered more than 100 original productions, including Aida by Elton John and Tim Rice and Alice Walker's The Color Purple. And it's really one of the venues that helped transform Atlanta's Midtown and the city at large into a destination for the arts. We're continuing our conversation with Michael Parver, who was there from the jump. He's now on Alliance Theater's Advisory Board and Jamie Clements, Director of Development at Alliance Theater. And I'm speaking to you on the day when we just learned that Carol Channing died, which is so sad.
Very sad.
Well, and she was a big Broadway star when Alliance Theater opened.
That's right.
And in many ways, you know, her career spanned lulls through live theater, now breaking records on Broadway, certainly. Michael, you tell me that Carol Channing was in productions here at Alliance.
Yes. No, not at the Alliance. This was with Theater of the Stars down at the Atlanta Civic Center.
Mm-hmm.
And she was here for a week. And the one thing she wanted to do was to meet President Carter, which he happened to be in town. So we set that up. But what was interesting about Carol, her diet was so specific. Well, no matter what restaurant you took her to, she brought her own food.
In Atlanta, of all places.
Right. And we had to make arrangements with the kitchen to put it onto their plates and bring it out with everybody else's.
Well, let's look at that sort of span, you know, through the life of Carol Channing, even on this day. Jamie, you've got a new season, a new play, new Coca-Cola stage. We talked about some of the adaptations, you know, to evolving an audience and in programming. So but what about the renovation of the physical space? What do people in the audience want now that they didn't get back in 1968?
You know, I think there's a sense of intimacy that audiences are searching for now. We want to be part of the story, inside the story, with technology and Netflix and everything else. You can be in your own comfort zone and get as many stories thrown at you with immersive sound and immersive time. But I think people crave a live experience where someone with a beating heart is standing in front of you. And in some cases, like Ever After, 28 someones are standing before you in a giant, beautiful cast telling a story that's timeless. I read an article recently that there are only 7 kinds of stories in the world, and they all stem back from
Rags. And Shakespeare owns 5 of them.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that's what we crave as humans. And I think that what we did with the renovation of the Alliance Theater's main stage into the absolutely stunning Coca-Cola stage, where I've just been going to sit and watch tech rehearsals for the last week, because it feels different. You feel a part of what's going on stage. You feel that you are, as Susan mentioned in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution article last week, you feel like you're being hugged by a warm forest, because, you know, the design was based off of Matthijs Plessing's gorgeous curved wood, bent wood architectural furniture. And so the entire room feels like you're sitting in a gorgeous piece of art. And it truly does feel that way. The acoustics are whisper sensitive, to where the person, regardless of where you're sitting, you're going to be able to hear every drop of everything that happens on the stage in the orchestra pit. And I think that's what we crave now. We are all seeking a way to detach from our devices, detach from our email, and those moments are becoming elusive. But when you step into a theater, when you step into especially a gorgeous theater that the Coca-Cola stage at the Alliance will be now, you are giving yourself back over to the oldest form of communication, the oldest form of entertainment, you know, around a campfire almost, of people to people, telling stories, relating what we already know, but we need to hear it over and over and over again to remain human. And that's what we're all looking for.
I've seen renderings of the new stage, and there's a terrific little time-lapse video of the renovations, pretty much down to the studs. I would really encourage listeners to go and have a look at that. But beyond that, there's the theater, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's the theater company and ensemble. This has been an equity theater for years. Mm-hmm. Can you explain just what that means for actors?
Sure. It's the labor union for actors. It's the way that they do collective bargaining for everything from benefits to pay for the stage. And we at the Alliance are committed to paying the people who tell us our stories as well as we possibly can. And we actually pay typically above equity rates at the Alliance Theater, because we believe in the storytellers as well.
So, Michael, what did that mean for actors?
Basically, it was guarantees that they're going to get paid for the work. Mm. And that is what we did originally. We had to become a total equity house for King Arthur.
Well, I'm curious about that. You know, now you have this artist lab that's been in operation for a couple of years at Alliance Theater to help give a home to other actors. But thinking about, you were mentioning earlier, Jamie, about how the theater culture that proliferated with Alliance Theater helped spawn things like Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater. Do you think that there's any role here in becoming a theater town in all of the actors and people who are techs and film now in the film production and television production industry? Did it seed that?
Well, you know, I think it absolutely helped. There's a base of technicians. There's a base of artists here. And when I say artists, I mean on stage and off stage, the people who paint scenery, the people who build costumes, build sets, the people who play in the pit of the orchestra. There was a base here in Atlanta that, you know, when the theater and film or the film and TV industry moved in, there were already people here. And we see it's a really interesting ecosystem now where we see people from, you know, smaller theater companies, smaller arts companies coming up through the Alliance, then going to lead those smaller companies or going through to TV and film production and cycling in and out. And so there's a base of artistry here in Atlanta that is truly stunning when you start to peel back the layers. And I think absolutely the Alliance, the Atlanta Symphony, the High Museum, the Woodruff Arts Center, but every other theater in town has something to do with that because we value the arts here in Atlanta and we want the world to know it.
How has that been able to continue to work and thrive for so many years in a state which is near the bottom of arts funding?
It's about generosity. Personal corporate generosity is unbelievable. You know, the Alliance is not unlike most major arts organizations around the country where we depend 50% or greater every year on philanthropic generosity. So we have, you know, 3,500 individual donors every year just to the Alliance Theater, not to mention the High Museum and the Atlanta Symphony and the Woodruff itself. And then we also, you know, more than 300 companies around Atlanta support the Arts Center and its mission. We have foundations that have been giving, both family foundations, national funders who have been supporting the work that we do for 50 years now. And it's truly incredible. And that's actually why the Coca-Cola stage has come to a reality. You know, we're not taking out massive loans to pay for this. We're fortunately able to pay cash for what's turned into a $32 million renovation, all because of the generosity of almost exclusively Atlantans and the foundations that have been set up here.
I'm thinking about Michael Howard 50 years ago trying to assure investors, prominent Atlanta businessmen, as it said at the time, that King Arthur was going to work. They came to see what this gamble was all about. They thought maybe it'll take 20 years to sort of gain back some momentum. Now you've been here for 50 years. How has that gamble paid off? How do you think, Mark, Michael?
To me, I am so delighted to be part of it. I've stood on the stage while it's being renovated and remembered 50 years back. What they are doing makes this the number one city outside of New York for theater, as far as I'm concerned. And I think one thing that we need to mention about the renovation, we have reduced the number of seats.
Yes, that's interesting.
Almost by 100. Uh-huh. And today, where they try cramming everybody in and increasing how many people can sit in a place, that was a gutsy thing to do.
Jamie, we have to wrap, but what do you think? What has Alliance done for, let's say, the culture, the general sense of being in Atlanta?
You know, I think it's evidenced most clearly by the number of incredible scripts that we get at the Alliance Theater, the number of stories that people want to tell here on our stage from all over the country, all over the world. If you could see the stacks and stacks and stacks of storytelling scripts that we get, that Susan has to come through with all of her artistic staff, that is the primary indicator to me that Atlanta is a place where stories want to be told. And I think that's very special.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Jamie and Michael. Pleasure to have you
thank
here.
You.
Ever After is going to begin its run tomorrow. It's in previews beginning tomorrow, and it's going to be running through February 17th. The Alliance Theater released this special Behind the Musical event with Sierra Bajas performing Who Needs Love. Well, we do know that transportation needs a little love here in Atlanta. And we know about the State of the Union, State of the State Address. The Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority just had its annual State of MARTA address. MARTA CEO Jeffrey Parker called for $100 billion investment in public transit.
We are fed up sitting in traffic. And if we continue to invest incrementally to improve public transportation, what will this look like in 30 years?
GPB reporter Ross Terrell was there at the address and with us now to talk transportation. Hello there, Ross.
How's it going?
Well, I'm just happy to have you here and learn more about this. This figure, $100 billion, a lot of money. So why that number?
Yeah, you aren't wrong. And the way they got the number is looking at what other large metro cities are investing. We talk D.C., Seattle, New York. But anyone who's been in Atlanta knows the traffic is awful. And this is the number that Parker believes we need to at least make a dent in that, whether that's new technology, better trains, more buses, more efficient transportation methods to get around the city and metro areas.
Is it a reasonable number, however? I mean, is MARTA going off the rails with this figure? See what I did there? Just saying.
Pretty clever. Not necessarily, actually. Last year in the legislative session, they passed House Bill 930. And what that did was set up a funding structure to get the 13 metro Atlanta counties involved and set up new pots of money to pull from. Parker doesn't know where this money is going to come from. It could be taxes. It could be federal grants. But the bottom line is lawmakers are aware, MARTA's aware, and people are aware we need more money for better transit.
How far does it go then? Which areas will be reached that haven't had public transportation until now?
Right. So essentially, the counties get a chance. They get a say. We know we have it here in Fullerton County in Atlanta. But when you talk about Cobb, Gwinnett, Clayton, Rockdale, they put that to a vote. A large one coming up is Gwinnett, March 19th. Their residents get to vote. And Cobb, they actually get to split up into special districts because down near the Braves Stadium, they may want transit where you talk about north. They don't need it. And then after a vote, they could set up whether they want to do a 0.5% sales tax and what services they want. Do they want light rail? Do they want more buses? What exactly will it look like in their communities?
When talking transportation, responsibility and expectations and blame all tend to fall on MARTA, but there are many more players. And of course, recently, Atlanta City Council adopted a plan to improve transportation. So what does that look like? How do they work together?
Yeah. So like you said, we think transportation and we think MARTA. But it's different. Now you have walking, you have bikes, you have the infamous scooters to some people. You have the Beltline. It's safer streets. It's safer methods. It's how can we exist on a street where somebody wants to drive and somebody wants to ride? It's more bike lanes, better sidewalks. And those are issues that you now have to start discussing when you look at transportation, not just how do we get trains to go everywhere.
Well, public transportation has become a partisan issue in many cities and states, you know, pitting spending and then, you know, freedom to drive your own car seems to be a big stand that people take. Is there cooperation there to actually make this happen?
It is. It's actually one of the issues that there is cooperation on both sides. As I mentioned earlier, the House bill that was passed, that cleared the Senate 48-6 and then cleared the House 155-19. You don't get something this large passed without buy-in. And that's from rural lawmakers. That's from urban lawmakers. And this was actually touted as one of Governor Deal's top accomplishments during his time in office, is setting up this structure to help transportation funding.
Have to go back to scooters.
Yes.
They propped up all over town, dumped over some places, not in other places, sort of left. Recently, a movement around legislating them. So what's been happening with scooters in Atlanta?
Right. So they essentially showed up overnight. One night you went to bed. Next morning you woke up, there were scooters. And there are a ton of companies. There's Bird, Lime, Lyft, Uber. They're electric bikes. But with the scooters, some people think they're kind of a nuisance. You ride them, you drop them off where you finish your trip, you pick them up wherever. And University of Georgia banned them. Athens placed a temporary ban on them. Macon actually votes later this evening on what to do with them. But here in Atlanta, they actually took some solid steps. Now, if you want to operate the scooters here, you need a $12,000 permit to operate 500. They set up speed limits. The scooters can only go 15 miles per hour on their own. Obviously, that picks up going downhill. You can ride them on the Beltline, which that was a large point of controversy for some people because motorized vehicles aren't allowed on the Beltline, but scooters now aren't motorized. And they advise that you wear a helmet. So now there are rules, regulations, and laws in place to kind of curb this new trend.
You've got a lot of miles on scooters. I happen to know that. Well, what do people who'd never tried them before need to know?
Yeah, crazy stat, I think, is with the last year, Lime scooters worldwide, 26 million rides. Ooh. I mean, you talk about something exploding overnight. I ride them to stories. I ride them to go pick up lunch. 15 miles per hour doesn't seem that fast. Number-wise, you know, our cars go up to 80-100. I could run 15 miles per hour for a short burst. But when you're just standing with no helmet on, it's kind of fast. I'd say be safe. Be aware of pedestrians. If you are on the sidewalk and there's a group, slow down. Walk your scooter around. But have fun and practice caution.
GPP's Ross Terrell giving us some updates and some pointers on transportation. Well, in honor of an event that will prompt some major traffic, in addition, to, of course, to Ever After premiering the Super Bowl, we're going to play Ross out with some Maroon 5, the band that will play at halftime. Stay with us to learn about growing old while remaining in your own home. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. I'm Virginia Prescott, GPB on Facebook. Always happy to be in touch. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Demographers call it a silver tsunami. 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 each day. According to the AARP, 90% of homeowners of retirement age say they want to spend their twilight years at home. Whether it's the high cost of assisted living and long-term care, fears of lost independence or comfort, it is now the biggest trend in senior living, and businesses and organizations are developing to support it. Doug Leader is advocacy chair of the National Aging in Place Council's chapter here in Greater Atlanta. He's also CEO and owner of Prosper Home Care and joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Well, good to be here.
Thank you for being here, Doug. And Heidi Ewan is joining us. She's from WUGA in Athens, adjunct faculty in housing management and policy at the University of Georgia, and director of healthcare management at the University of Indianapolis. And Heidi, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Heidi, you've done extensive research on aging in place. Could you explain for listeners who aren't familiar with the concept what that really means?
Sure. I actually began in this area in 1999, and it was interesting at the time. People want to stay in their homes for the duration of their lives for a variety of different reasons. You know, home has the meaning of your personality. It's an expression of who you are. It's a place where your memories are held. For many older adults, it's paid for, so it's not an expense. So really, you are aging in place until you're not.
Doug, would you want to add anything to that, Doug?
Absolutely. I agree with everything that Heidi said. And also, I think studies show that people actually have better health outcomes when living at home versus facilities.
Does aging in place mean that people stay in their homes, or could they be somewhere else, like an assisted living facility?
It could be somewhere else. I think any place that people are living, it could be assisted living, it could be a personal care home. It could be a renovated apartment in a child's home. Wherever they choose to stay and age in place is the place, you know, that they will be.
Heidi, why are so many people making this choice now?
Actually, it's been a pretty consistent trend. If you look at the census data, and we have some data from the Health and Retirement Study that go back at least 30 years, we find that 90 to 95% of older people do remain in their homes in their later years.
So when we're talking about this kind of care and for people who are seniors, elders, in fact, maybe you could clarify for me, what do people want to be called?
Good question. I think seniors or elders or just individuals that are getting up in their years. I don't know if there's a common term.
Is there something that, this is a conversation that a lot of people avoid, you know, where are you going to spend your elder years?
So how do adult children get that conversation started with a parent or a loved one?
You know, it's a difficult one, and it shouldn't be like, you know, talking about bad breath or you have spinach on your teeth. I mean, this is something that everybody lives and breathes, right? And unfortunately, I think too many times it doesn't happen until after an event, after mom has a fall or after dad has a stroke. And then you're in that situation where you have to say, look, you guys, what are your wishes? We're going to have to talk about this. In a perfect world, mm-hmm. if you have a good relationships with your parents or your elderly loved ones, hopefully you can bring it up in advance and say, hey, let's talk about it because I want to know what your wishes are. And we don't want to be in a situation where something does take place and then it's too late to plan in advance. And there are tools and resources out there to help people make that proper planning. In fact, on the National Aging in Place website, there's a tool called the ACT 3 tool. And it can walk people through the whole paradigm of is your residence properly equipped, and do you have resources, do you have transportation, do you have access to your support group? Because those are the things that are necessary to really age in place in the right way.
Well, I want to dig into those a little bit, but Heidi, I know that you have had that conversation with your parents. Tell us about the conversations that you had with them and what they did decide to do.
Yeah. There came a time when my parents, who were living in this 3,000-square-foot farmhouse on 2 acres of land, they were experiencing some health declines, and I came home and I found my dad out on the riding lawnmower, and he was holding his oxygen tank on his lap. And I remember sitting them down and saying, you know, this really isn't sustainable. Somebody's going to get injured, or you're going to spend all of your money paying for somebody to help come in and take care of this home. We really need to start looking at something that's all on one level, or we need to find something else for you to do. And I was pulled aside by a family member who said, you need to leave them alone, because if you move old people, they die. And we kind of went back and forth on that. And I joke tongue in cheek that inspired my career, that I've spent 20 years trying to prove this person wrong, only to discover that we're both partly right. So if an older person wants to age in place in their home, like my parents did, they refused to go. They started shutting off the upstairs. They weren't providing heat up there, just in the areas where they were living. People will modify their environment to be able to stay there. They'll rearrange furniture so that they have something to hold on to as they walk from room to room, or they'll modify their behavior in order to be able to access just what they need within that home. However, I think as Doug had said a minute ago, if people are to move, if they're forced into it, if their kids trick them into it, they don't do well. And in fact, it can lead to declines. It's demoralizing to be removed from your home or to be tricked into leaving. If it's a decision that they've made on their own, people will thrive. Actually, a lot of people will say, I wish I would have done this much sooner. Mm-hmm. But we see a crop of these different agencies who are coming up who are designed to help people age in place. People who do suffer health declines, like my father had oxygen. There's home oxygen delivery services. He could have physical or occupational therapy brought in home. You have folks who can come in to help with house cleaning or help with transportation to get to different doctor's appointments or places where they need to be. And that infrastructure we're seeing is being built up to help facilitate aging in place. There are new networks that are cropping up. There's a village movement where people in a community will come together and they'll lobby to have resources brought into that community. We are seeing, really in the big cities, there were these neighborhoods where people had moved in when they were younger and they raised their families there. They became familiar with one another and made friendships. And as their families grew up and the kids left home, these folks wanted to stay in their apartments, so they banded together. They're called naturally occurring retirement communities. Mm-hmm. And you find these in the suburbs as well. You're going to find neighborhoods where people are aging in place within their own communities, and they're reaching out for these home and community-based services, and they're looking at these different organizations with plans, layouts, suggestions on how to best be able to do that.
Well, I have to tell you, that's a conversation I've had with friends of mine. You know, we fantasize about we're going to have a commune and we're all going to live there together and combine resources when we get older. But there is one of the big concerns about aging in place is that it can become very isolating. Doug, what are you seeing? We just got a number of things as suggestions from Heidi, things that support people being together. How about with your organization? What are you doing?
Well, of course, being in the home care business, a lot of times my caregivers become kind of the family and the social interaction with so many of these clients. If their children have moved away or passed away and they don't have much of that family or friend support group, we can help fill that gap. Of course, we hope we're not the only ones. It's always nicer when there are friends or family close by. But that's a very important factor of planning to age in place, is you need to make sure you do have that support group in place, whether it's your spiritual community or just your family community or friends or other types of groups. You have to plan to not get isolated, because that's a very big danger of aging in place. Loneliness and isolation are not good.
Heidi also mentioned some of the things that her parents did to alter their home. What are some of the practical infrastructure, building, actual physical space adjustments that people need to make for aging in place?
Well, I think you have to try to arrange that you don't have to deal with stairs, whether you're able to put in an elevator or a stair lift. That's a huge one, because stairs are dangerous, and lots of falls and broken hips and worse happen because of stairs, ramps, etc. Also having a wheelchair accessible shower, having an extra room that's accessible for a caregiver. If you're really hoping to age in place all the way to the end, sometimes you'll have a live-in caregiver as the best option to be able to facilitate living in place. So those are biggies.
The state of Georgia has the 10th fastest growing population of people over the age of 85 in the U.S. And I'm speaking about the biggest trend in senior living, which is aging in place. Heidi Ewan is from the University of Georgia and Indianapolis with us. And Doug Leader, he is also here. He's from the Greater Atlanta Chapter of the National Aging in Place Council and CEO and owner of Prosper Home Care. This is something that I think has been coming. It comes up a lot in my cohort, let's say, you know, middle-aged, taking care of kids and also taking care of parents. And I remember an interview with the author, surgeon, Harvard Medical School educator, Atul Gawande. He wrote a lot about, you know, medicalization of aging, that we feel like we have to care for it or intervene. But there are truly some real concerns about safety and level of care as we're thinking about aging in place and end-of-life care. So you've both described a couple of things that people can do to change their surroundings, but can they really stay there? Can they continue if they are in danger of falling frequently or in great decline?
I think every situation is different, but you're right. You have to look at that carefully, and you have to make sure you do have the ability, both the financial ability and the facility that can accommodate having the assistance you need. Because when people get to the point where they are a fall risk, you know, at some point it's not always possible to age in place. But if you have the resources, gosh, you hope people have secured long-term care insurance, because Medicare doesn't pay for home care. It'll pay for home health care, skilled nursing, but not so much for the non-skilled assistance with just bathing, dressing, toileting, meal preparation, medication reminders, light housekeeping, transportation, many of the things that really fall into the home care category. So it requires some planning, both financial and facility planning, to be able to do that.
Resources are a big deal. Obviously, assisted living in Georgia can cost thousands of dollars per month, and even more for memory care. Retrofitting your home can cost a lot of money. So it's not cheap, certainly. Heidi, in the studies that you've done, what kind of financial comparisons are people making? Is it clear whether it's more expensive to age in place and have somebody come in for care or assisted living?
Actually, the research shows that it is less expensive for folks to age in place in their homes. Mm-hmm. The cost of institutional care is phenomenally high. It can be $10,000 a month. And people who are willing to make those behavioral modifications or even make those home modifications do very well. And they're committed to aging in place. They really take those services seriously. I've been really encouraged by the number of contractors and builders here in Georgia who are becoming certified aging-in-place specialists. Hmm. So they're learning how to build houses or to modify houses to help those folks age in place, and also to locate different types of resources to help them do that. I was talking with some folks here in Athens last year, and they were lamenting the fact that the housing here is built, and you know, you have pockets where you've got the older homes and then you've got the newer homes and you've got these different styles. Well, the tri-level homes are impossible to mm-hmm. age in place.
Yeah.
But some of the other ones, it's pretty easy to widen a doorway or even to change the door facings that you have. There are some that will fold open if you have like a double hinge, and that'll give you an extra 2 inches there. But the homes that have been modified for folks who are aging in place are actually selling a lot faster than the traditional homes, because there is going to be a greater need for homes that are equipped that way.
Mm-hmm. Let's get on to caregivers. And before we close, Doug, part of what makes this decision so difficult is that when older people aren't fully able to care for themselves and need to hire someone to come in for some of those basic things that you talked about, this is something that really rings true for you. You had to trust in caregivers for your younger brother who was badly injured in a car accident. So what did you learn about looking for and, let's say, demanding in caregivers?
Well, you know, in being part of a family that had a disabled individual, my younger brother ended up as a C5, C6 quadriplegic because of a car accident. And so although I grew up with a mother as a nurse and knew about caregiving, that was really my thrust into learning about caregivers. And I learned how to be one myself, and I learned about many wonderful stories of Dan's caregivers, but also there was many bad ones. There was caregivers that didn't show up to work. There was caregivers mm-hmm. that stole from Dan. And I think, you know, and that was part of my drive to become a home care provider, is I wanted to do a better job. And you got to vet the caregivers. If you ever have to hire a caregiver, mm-hmm. go with an agency that does the background checks. We're a Georgia certified drug-free workplace. Do the drug test, do the reference checks, make sure they're training these caregivers. We also have a system to make sure that the caregivers are clocking in and clocking out using GPS, so we know when they're there, and it sends us an alert when they're not, because when a lot of those factors aren't in place, things can fall through the cracks, and you're trusting an individual. A lot of times it's a one-on-one individual in a home with a loved one, and those folks are, mm-hmm. are vulnerable, so it takes a lot of supervision and a lot of careful vetting to make sure you've got good folks.
Well, Heidi, we've just got a minute before we're up against the end of the show, but we're talking about families, but how about the state of Georgia, 10th fastest growing population of people over 85 years old. Is the state prepared to care for its aging population in the coming years?
It's always going to be a struggle, and those frontline workers, they turn over pretty quickly. I think we're seeing a lot more programs that are coming up, a lot more good training programs for those frontline caregivers to make sure that we are prepared. I think we need a lot more folks like Doug and leaders of these different agencies who are skilled not only in business management, but also understanding the aging services network and are willing to put in that extra effort to make sure that they are high quality, good quality employees.
Heidi Ewan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Heidi Ewan is adjunct assistant professor in housing management and policy. That's at UGA. She's also director of healthcare management at the University of Indianapolis. And Doug Leader, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Doug is CEO and owner of Prosper Home Care and advocacy chair of the Greater Atlanta chapter of the National Aging in Place Council. And that is our show for today on Second Thought. It's produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Tyler Morris is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.